This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We made a mistake that will crash the 2-degree warming guardrail not by 2100, but before 2030. That is coming right up. Our second interview is with the co-founder of the Transition Town movement, Rob Hopkins, with his personal transition. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's get going. Imagine you are a scientist exploring the secrets of the atom. Then society takes that discovery to make bombs that blow up cities. Now imagine you study the way water breaks up rock underground. It's an obscure specialty until industry leaders decide to use that data to explode the underground for methane, also known as natural gas. Money is made, but that technological choice blows up the future. They call it fracking. Since 1977, Dr. Anthony R. Engrafia has been a popular professor teaching structural mechanics and fracture mechanics at Cornell University in New York State. He and his students published over 200 scientific papers. Engrafia has been a lead investigator in projects for major corporations like Boeing and Grumman and for government agencies like NASA and the National Science Foundation. He's won a ton of awards for his work. When it comes to fracking rock, this is an expert's expert. From Ithaca, New York, Anthony Engrafia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the honor of being with you today, Alex.
Is it all right if I call you Tony?
Please do.
Okay. Now, in 2011, you and another professor at Cornell, Robert Howarth, published two major papers on the climate impacts of fracking. And in November 2011, I interviewed Dr. Howarth and broadcast the Radio EcoShock show titled Fracking Gas Equals Climate Crash. Now it's 7 years later. We knew what was coming. Has the gamble of frack gas turned out as you thought it would?
Unfortunately, it did. And I don't mean that in a positive sense. I mean that in a negative sense. What my colleague Bob Howarth and I predicted in our 2011 papers has unfortunately been borne out by subsequent science done by many people in government, in academia, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
Well, let's go back a bit. Tony, what were you studying about underground rock before frack gas became a mainstay of energy production in North America?
I had begun studying fracture of rock in my doctoral studies in the mid-1970s, initially to try to understand how to mine rock for heat, also known as geothermal energy production. But very soon after I joined academia in 1977, we had a president at that time who was gung-ho on renewable energy, and he was followed by a president who was anti-gung-ho on renewable energy. So research and development in mining heat turned into research and development in mining more gas and more oil. So before the shale revolution began early in this century, I was working with the oil and gas industry to enhance their capabilities for hydraulically fracturing rock that was not shale in order to produce more oil and gas from increasingly stingy deposits around the world. So it wasn't until early this century that the industry unlocked finally the formula, the technological formula for getting oil and gas out of shale. So I had done some preliminary research in that area way back in the early 80s, courtesy of the United States Department of Energy and the U.S. taxpayer. But that was a different time then. We weren't very conscious at that point in the early 1980s about climate change or the environmental impacts, the negative environmental impacts that development of oil and gas from shale would really wreak.
You were in the right time and place. Maybe you could have become very, very wealthy with your fracking expertise. Why didn't you join the big race to frack everywhere?
I'm pausing to answer that question, Alex, because my wife asks me the same thing frequently. And I actually get accused by people who don't like the message I bring that I have enriched myself. I haven't. I don't take any remuneration for any of the public education I've done over the last decade or so in trying to inform the public and regulators and legislators and governors and even the president about the negative aspects of shale gas. Certainly I've been invited by a number of oil and gas entities to rejoin the industry to help them improve the process of stimulating shale gas and stimulating oil out of shale. But I've chosen not to because I made a conscious decision 10 years ago that that was a very bad thing to do from a technological point of view, from a climate change point of view, and personally from a moral and ethical point of view.
Speaking of fracking everywhere, if a corporation wants to locate an industry with truckloads of toxic chemicals and lots of air pollution and noise, they are regulated usually into an industrial park or something. How is it possible in America to find fracking pads right next to schools or hospitals or even among homes in American suburbs?
I'm pausing again, Alex. I wish I knew, because I have spent a tremendous amount of time over the last 10 years involved in lawsuits brought by families who are suffering the consequences of exactly what you just described. They were quite comfortable living in a urban residential area or a rural residential area, typically in a zoned community, and they woke up one morning to find themselves in the middle of an industrial operation, a heavy industrial operation that is the only one, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, that is permitted to go beyond the normal bounds of zoning. That's that issue. What can zoning do? What can a local community do to enforce its own zoning regulations is at the heart of literally dozens of lawsuits that are occurring every day around the country in many states. And to directly answer your question, it's beyond me how we got there. The oil and gas industry is the only one, to my best knowledge, that has that exceptional power to overrule local zoning powers to keep an industrial, a heavy industrial activity restricted to an industrial zone. It's literally allowed to go every place that you just described. It can be in my backyard, your backyard, within a few hundred feet of a school or a daycare center, within a few hundred feet of a hospital, within a few hundred feet of a food store. That's the way that things have developed in this country, largely because of the excuse of we need the energy and we have to get the energy. And today they use phrases like energy independence or more currently energy dominance or energy security. And the point is that fossil fuel source is one source of energy, but it's not the only source of energy, and it's not the only one that we could be tapping right now to meet all of our energy needs while at the same time making us energy secure and energy independent. So hidden in all the words I just gave you is the word politics, the word lobbying, the word influence. But I'm not qualified to talk about those things. I'm just an engineer, and I'm befuddled, absolutely confused about why it is that we can allow this heavy industrial energy to invade, literally invade our communities.
And your video presentation, though, does suggest five narrowly defined goals that sound like good reasons to introduce this technology. Can we talk about those and what they are?
Sure. These are the what I called in my video for the Bedrock series, the narrowly defined goals of the development of shale for oil and gas. The five narrowly defined goals are jobs, economic growth, energy security, energy independence, lower energy prices, and the displacement of dirty coal from our energy picture. Those are all very good objectives, very good goals. And to a large extent, in many locales around this country, we have succeeded to some degree in all five of those. But the point I'm making in my video is that complete success in all five of those areas is still a narrow victory, because it would only benefit about 5% of the world's population. And every one of those has an impact on 100% of the world's population. So it's easy for me to understand how an industry can convince regulators, legislators, from the local level all the way up to the federal level, that these narrowly defined goals are good things. It's obvious that they're good things. But the larger question is, for whom are they good? Well, they're certainly good for gas and oil companies and their shareholders. They're certainly good for some local businesses until the bust comes. They were certainly bad for coal. They were temporary in some cases because obviously lower prices for some fossil fuels are going to go away as our fossil fuel resources deplete again, as they inevitably will. They are not renewable. And the concept of energy security, energy independence, as I just pointed out a few minutes ago, is ephemeral. The best way for the United States and every single country on the face of the earth to be both energy secure and energy independent is to produce all the energy it needs within its own borders. And the easy way to do that is with renewable energy. It's the easy way for the United States to become energy secure and energy independent.
You then go to the broader unintended consequences, and these are super important. They're huge. First, could you make your case that fracking caused the elongation of the fossil fuel era?
Yes. So the amount of oil and natural gas being produced in the United States was on the decline. Both oil and gas were on the decline, both from onshore and offshore sources, up until the discovery that it was possible to get oil and gas out of a heretofore unobtainable source, shale. The real revolution that we should be talking about is not fracking. Fracking isn't new. The real revolution was the application of a very specific form of fracking to a form of rock that had never been fracked before, and that's shale. So what was happening at the turn of the last century, in 1990s to 2000, is that we were rapidly depleting our own supplies of natural gas and oil. And other countries around the world were also depleting their supplies. And had we been wise at that point, and by then we recognized that climate change was upon us because of the use of fossil fuels, and had we been wise to see that we had wonderfully modern and cleaner means of supplying energy to all the countries on the face of the earth, renewables, we would have just ridden that decline all the way to its end. And my insight is that by this time, 2018, had we not turned to shale, we would be much farther along in the renewable energy transition that has now been delayed by 20 years. So the brief answer to your question is we were running out of everything. The United States had gotten to the point where it was only producing about a third of the oil that it needed, and we were importing natural gas, literally importing it because we could not meet demand. And what shale has allowed us to do is almost double the amount of oil we're producing and to increase by over 30% the amount of natural gas we're producing. And that's a definition of elongation, whereas we should have been in decline naturally because we were running out of stuff. We suddenly opened this door. We opened the cellar door, what I call the dark, dank basement of the fossil fuel resource on the face of the earth, the last remaining dark, dank corner, shale gas, shale oil. We figured out a way to get it out. We took that technological gamble, and here we sit 20 years farther into a fossil fuel era that should have been dead by now.
And you graphed out a timeline of the growth of shale gas fracking and the early exponential growth of wind power. Talk to us about that relationship and how much potential wind power was lost because of shale gas.
It's remarkably coincidental that I can show three graphs that all have what I refer to as kinks in them. And all those kinks occur in roughly the same period, 2005 to 2010. So let me remind your listeners that in 2005-2010 is when shale gas and shale oil really took off. So the three curves that have these remarkably coincident kinks are, number one, natural gas production in the United States. In that same era, 2005-2010, we were in decline. We were actually importing natural gas. And suddenly there's a kink, and we have a drastic increase in natural gas from shale. Is that a coincidence? Well, what's cause and what's effect here? The other coincidence is if we look at a graph of methane concentration in the atmosphere, we see that over the period roughly 1990 to 2002, 2003, the concentration of methane in the atmosphere was flat. It wasn't increasing. It wasn't decreasing. It was remaining the same. Suddenly and coincidentally, in that same period, 2005, 2010, we're seeing a drastic increase in methane concentration in the atmosphere, which is very important because methane is the second most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide. And the third coincidental kink in a curve is if I make a graph of the amount of wind energy that's available in the United States, starting at the beginning of this century and up until about 2007, 2008, we were on what a mathematician would call an exponential growth curve. The amount of wind energy being produced in the U.S. was roughly doubling every year. And then in that same period, 2005, 2010, that exponential growth died out. It kinked. It became linear. In other words, it keeps increasing, but at a much slower rate. So we have these three coincidental kinks and three closely coupled curves. They're all interrelated. They all result from that technological gamble that the operators and legislators and governors and presidents decided to take roughly 15 years ago, and here we are. We have these coincidences, and none of them are good. The worst of them is that methane concentration in the atmosphere continues to rise, and that's exacerbating climate change.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest, Professor Emeritus Anthony Arangrafia, was a pioneer in rock fracturing science at Cornell University. He says fracking gas is a gamble with the world's climate that we can't afford, no matter how cheap the gas appears to be. So, Tony, the final and worst unintended consequence, which you've touched on here and in your YouTube video, is about the worsening of climate change due to a new dependence on burning shale gas. And your first graph is from a paper led by Drew Schindel of NASA, published in the journal Science in 2011. Tony, what did their data show about the warming of the Earth since 1900, and then tell us about their projections?
What their paper showed, what the graph they're referring to that was in their paper showed that in the period 1900 to 2009, global warming had occurred to a degree of about 7/10 of 1 degree centigrade. So relative to the average temperature between 1890 and 1910, that was their zero, global warming had occurred at about 7/10 of a degree centigrade by 2009. And that was generally accepted by scientists around the world. They also, in their paper, decided to use computer simulation, the very, very best computer simulation that was available in 2010, 2011, to try to forecast, based on the history of global warming to that date, how global warming would occur over the next century. And, of course, they tried a number of different scenarios depending upon what the world was going to do with fossil fuel and greenhouse gases. And they realized that their computer simulations were, of course, just fortune-telling. They weren't truth. They were the very best scientific effort to try to predict what would happen. And so they were subject to error. And in their paper, they showed four different scenarios of what might happen between 2010 and 2070. And they also showed the error bars on their predictions. How far off do you think they could be high? How far off do you think they could be low on each of these four scenarios? And what they showed in their original paper is that regardless of which scenario you picked, we were going to get to 1.5 degrees centigrade by about 2050 or before, or in some cases way before, by 2020. And people were saying, well, geez, we have plenty of time. You know, the worst is 2 degrees centigrade. But their paper also showed that we would get to 2 degrees centigrade by as early as 2040, or perhaps not until later this century, depending upon which scenario. So I show that graph in my video, and then I show a new version of that graph because the graph is old. It was published in 2011. And the data, the actual measurement of global warming, had been made 8 more times since that paper was first published. So what I did was to take the NASA-measured global temperatures for each of the 8 years after 2009, and I put those points on a new version of the graph. So in other words, I was adding data to the data that was in the original graph, which is what had happened between 1900 and 2009, went up 7/10 degrees centigrade. And to my disconsternation, when I plotted these additional 8 points, I found that we were already at 1.5 degrees centigrade in 2017. So the dreams and hopes of the Paris Accord that we would do our very best worldwide to try to avoid 1.5 degrees centigrade is a pipe dream. We're basically already there. And when I plot those new 8 points on this revised graph, I see that all of the simulations, all the predictions by simulation made by Shindel and his colleagues were wrong. They expected them to be wrong, but they were wrong in the worst possible way. Every one of them under-predicted the rate of global warming. The worst-case scenario that they predicted in 2011 was that we would not get to 1.5 degrees centigrade until about 2040, but we're already there.
And you suggest that we might reach 2 degrees centigrade, which is sort of the let's go to catastrophe mark, as early as 2030. Are you confident in that?
I'm not confident. I'm scared to death, but I'm looking at the data and trying to visualize an extrapolation through these new 8 points, which of course don't all fall on the line. They do what all the temperature measurements made in history do. They go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. But in general, they're showing an increase. And if I just plot a straight line through those 8 points, we're at 2 degrees centigrade before 2040.
Okay, so in 2011, you and Robert Howarth of Cornell published two papers, and the most cited is published in Climatic Change, and it reports that frack gas, if I may summarize, results in far more greenhouse gases than either the government or industry were reporting, and I believe you said frack gas was more polluting than coal. Is that correct?
From a climate change point of view, absolutely correct. It's because when you burn natural gas, you get carbon dioxide, just like you do when you burn coal. You get less carbon dioxide than you get by burning coal for the same amount of energy produced. But methane, natural gas, is also a greenhouse gas. And any methane, natural gas, that gets into the atmosphere unburned turns out to be about 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a global warming agent over a period of about 10 to 20 years. And I just got through telling you and your audience that we only have 10 to 20 years to worry about this problem and fix it. Let me rephrase. Over the next 10 to 20 years, every kilogram of methane that gets into the atmosphere unburned is 100 times more powerful, more potent as a greenhouse gas warming agent than carbon dioxide, meaning any small amount of methane is equivalent to a very large amount of carbon dioxide. And what we said in our 2011 paper was that we thought then, and we still think now, that a significant percentage of natural gas that's mined in the U.S. and in Canada and in Argentina from shale gets into the atmosphere unburned because of purposeful venting or accidental leakage. And we said that significant percentage is somewhere around 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%. And it doesn't matter whether it's 8% or 6% or 5%. If it's more than about 2 or 3%, it's deadly from a climate change point of view. It's worse than all the other fossil fuels.
But in the other article published in 2011 in the journal Nature, you and Robert Howarth argued that fracking should stop. But Terry Engelder from Penn State University said, and I quote, "The good news is that methane has a very short half-life in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide emitted during the building of the first Sumerian cities is still affecting our climate, whereas escaped methane from the fracturing of the Barnett Shale in 1997 is more than half gone." So isn't that a good news story? That's sort of the industry point of view.
Well, Terry Engelder is a good friend of mine, and we vehemently disagree. what he said is correct. But I said right before you said what he said is also correct. Methane only resides in the atmosphere for about 10 or 12 years, and then it becomes mostly carbon dioxide. But during those 10 or 12 years, it is a very potent warming agent. And I just got through telling you and your listeners that we only have 10 or 15 years to fix the problem. So during the 10 or 15 years that we have to fix the problem, all the methane that's being exhausted into the atmosphere today is warming.
Well, we won't have time in this interview to talk about fracked oil and its effect on the climate, and that just adds on to the whole problem.
Yes, it does.
It does. Okay. Now, In your video, you asked about, well, what do you think is happening in other countries? And I note that the French President Emmanuel Macron just visited the U.S. He dined with President Trump and then told a joint session of Congress that, yes, we should worry about climate change. If, according to the map in your published paper, France has a world-class reserve of natural gas waiting in its rock formations, what is happening with fracking there?
Absolutely nothing. It's forbidden.
Wow.
So France has taken the path of there shall be no shale gas development. But I already mentioned two countries that have followed the United States lead. In fact, the suggested lead of the United States way back in the Obama administration. Here is U.S. technology that we want to export. We're going to show you how to get oil and gas out of shale. And Canada is the second largest producer of oil and gas out of shale. And the third largest producer is now Argentina. And there are at least a handful of countries around the world that are exploring, experimenting with using this relatively newfound American technology, directional drilling, high-volume fracking, special chemical formulations, clustered multi-well pads. All that adds up into getting oil and gas out of shale. And so we've now exported. We've made the problem worse because not only are we doing it, and adding our extra carbon dioxide and our extra methane into the atmosphere, we're encouraging other countries to do the same thing.
Would those countries include the UK or Australia?
The UK, there is now fracking permitted in England. It's not permitted in Scotland. It's not permitted in Ireland. Australia, some of the provinces of Australia have said no, they're in moratorium. Others have just decided that they're going to begin exploration.
And you end your recent YouTube presentation by asking what each of us can do to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. Some folks in North Carolina are taking it to the streets. They're trying to fight off more fracking by their energy giant, Duke Energy. Isn't local resistance a big part of trying to stop the shale gas menace?
Yes, it is. And any kind of nonviolent resistance, activism, advocacy, is exactly what we need. We need to depress the supply side of fossil fuels and also depress the demand side. That's what each individual can do. That's what I tried to emphasize in my video. So if you are taking an advocacy position or a peaceful activist position to try to get corporations and legislators and governors to slow down or even prohibit the development of shale gas and shale oil, you're depressing the supply side, and that's good. If you decide on the demand side that you're going to stop using a fossil fuel, for example, to drive your car or to heat your home or to heat your hot water or to cook the hot dogs in your kitchen or to light the light bulbs in your house, that's also a good thing to do. Both of those send messages to the market. We are a capitalist society. The transition that we're in right now from fossil fuel-based energy resources to non-fossil fuel-based energy resources is one that will be won in the marketplace. So who rules the marketplace? Consumers. So stop consuming or decrease your consumption of fossil fuels. Do what you can to inhibit the supply using peaceful means, even if it's a letter to the editor or carrying a banner in a protest march, or putting a sign in your front lawn, or voting for people who think the way you do about this energy transition. That's all good stuff. And at the same time, vote with your pocketbook and make sure that your next car is an electric car. Make sure that you really investigate whether you can heat your home and cool your home with an electric-driven heat pump where the electricity is coming from a renewable source. See what you can do about putting solar panels on your property, or buying into a community solar farm. See what you can do to help the development of wind farms in your area rather than inhibiting them. These are all the kinds of things that individuals can and must do as participants in what has to be an energy transition, because if we don't have the energy transition, we're going to have the worst of climate change, and we don't have much time to do this. We've only got about a decade of years in which we can make significant change.
We have been talking with Dr. Anthony R. Engrafia, the emeritus holder of the Dwight C. Baum Professorship in Engineering at Cornell University. Ironically, this strong opponent of the modern fracking industry is one of the most published authors on how rocks fracture. And you can find links to his must-watch YouTube video that we've been talking about and all the papers we've discussed and more about shale gas fracking in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tony and Graffia, thank you for helping us understand the gamble we've taken.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If you think the future looks troubled, a personal bunker is not the answer. We will need each other and resilient communities. Dr. Rob Hopkins is a world leader in that quest. He is a co-founder of the Transition Town Movement, the Transition Network, and author of essential books like The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, and The Transition Companion, Making Your Community More Resilient in Uncertain Times. We're going to talk about Rob's new venture and his shorthand guide to going forward. Rob Hopkins, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
I've been wanting to talk to you for some time, and I noticed looking at your blog on March 13th, 2017, you announced that while still helping the transition movement, you would take some time off to explore a new topic. How has that worked out for you and for the Transition Town movement?
Well, it's sort of still work in progress, and I still do a lot with transition. I still do a lot of traveling and speaking and stuff. But I've been doing some research around imagination, and I read a piece of research a few years ago that was a researcher in the US who gathered together something called the Torrance Test for Creative Thinking over the last sort of 60, 70 years in the US. And her conclusion was that IQ and imagination rose together until 1990, and then they parted company, and IQ kept rising and imagination started to decline. And when she published it, it was on the front page of Newsweek. It was a really big story. What does this mean for economic growth and for Silicon Valley and for Hollywood? I never heard anybody in the climate change, social justice movements who even mentioned it. And it struck me as a really interesting thing, you know, that what we're trying to do in transition and in many other similar movements is to help people imagine a different future, you know, reimagine what's in front of us in a different way. And maybe if actually there's a problem with our collective imagination, that's something we need to give some thought to and work out some strategies for how to manage that.
And are you planning that to be a book? Is that the thought?
Yeah, that's the plan at the moment. It's going quite slowly, but that is the plan, yeah.
All right. Well, here's what I propose. I'd like to start with a dialogue with a bit of chat on imagination and then work back to community resilience and how to get there. Does that sound all right?
Perfect. That sounds great, yeah.
Great. So I looked at Wikipedia, which isn't always that authoritative, but it has this definition for the word imagination. It says that imagination, the ability to form images, ideas, and sensations in the mind without any immediate input of the senses, such as seeing or hearing. And if you could let me explain for a minute, I think there's a possible dangerous side to that. And that's because, as you know, Rob, in the Dark Ages, people valued imagination more than their senses, and we got witches and other imaginary beings. And then Francis Bacon comes along and conceives of science in order to bring humans back to their senses to deal with things as they are, measurable, hard, and real, and it's sort of a guide against the perils of imagination. How do you see that relationship between imagination that we should cultivate and science?
Yeah, I mean, the definition that I like is a woman called Maxine Green, who said that imagination is the ability to look at things as if they could be otherwise. And actually, that's really been the foundation of most great science. You know, Albert Einstein went out on his bicycle and cycled about and daydreamed and imagined himself as an atom flying through the universe. I don't see that there's any, that it's, you know, either we have imagination or we have science. You know, most of the best science really has its roots in the imagination and then in a way that's kind of tested rigorously and so on. But, you know, I think for me, the problem at the moment is that we seem to have put all of our eggs into the scientific basket, I suppose. And we have less and less opportunities in our lives, I think, in 2018 to allow our imaginations to really flourish. You know, our education system has become much more about learning stuff, passing exams, being tested from the age of four, much less room for the arts and for play and for being imaginative. Our workspace is often much more, you know, ticking boxes and so on and so on. And then universities, there seems to be less space for it. The time when we would wander around and daydream and allow ideas to come to us, we seem to be filling up with hours and hours spent on smartphones and on Facebook and so on. You know, so for me, it's not that we need imagination exclusively, because if we just folk cultivated purely the imagination, we'd all just wander around and not achieve very much. But if we are trying to figure out a way forward in the times we are in now, with the challenges that we face, then having a really strong, healthy imagination, the ability to ask what if, which lies at the heart of science, I think is also something that needs to really lie at the heart of our activism.
And what about technology? Is that anti-imaginary?
Certainly not by definition. You know, there's lots of technology that can really help and facilitate that. But I think we seem to increasingly be seeing forms of technology which are about capturing our attention and holding our attention and giving us very little in return. And these sort of dopamine-driven apps and tools that are, I think, very harmful to the imagination. One of the guys I spoke to, a neuroscientist, he said, I think that our imagination, the degree to which our imaginative is, runs opposite to the amount of time that we spend on our smartphones. There is a kind of a bit of a perfect storm of things that are coming together that are really not helping the imagination, in terms of we spend a lot less time out of doors, we spend a lot more time in front of screens, you know, 60% of our time awake, we sleep less because of these devices. And I think when we start to look at all these things together, I think our imaginations are really quite challenged, because in order to have a healthy imagination, we need to have spaces where we come together with other people to be imaginative, and we know people spend less and less time engaging with each other. We need to be rested. We need to have we need to have a space where we can do that, and we have less and less time in our lives to just look out the window, dream, talk with other people. How could it be? And I think that's a real danger.
You know, what you've just said with the neuroscience, I wonder, is there a particular part of the brain where imagination takes place, and could it wither away as we watch our prepared media, movies and games and television?
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the things that's been most interesting to me, is there's a small part in the brain called the hippocampus, which people always associated mainly with memory, as it being the center of the memory. And although, you know, there's, I suppose when I was a kid, you know, you'd sometimes see those sort of china heads, you know, with the different parts of the brain being put down to different things. That idea that each aspect of us is belongs to a different part of the brain is something that they're really moving away from now, neuroscientists, and saying, actually, it's about networks and different networks that fire at different times when we're doing different things. And there are particular networks that are connected to the imagination, but the hippocampus is really central to all of those. So it's the place where our memory exists, but it's also where we imagine the future. And the thing with the hippocampus is that it is uniquely vulnerable to cortisol. So when people are traumatized, when people are stressed, when people are very frightened, neuroscientists can see on scans that the hippocampus visibly shrinks. When children are brought up in environments that are traumatic and unstimulating and stressful, they have visibly smaller hippocampi than people who don't have that. So I think that there's something about when we live in a world which is constantly pumping out dystopian visions of the future, fearful messages, when we are in a high state of anxiety, we can't even put our phone down without feeling anxious that we might miss something, then I think we're at a time when, you know, our hippocampi are very vulnerable and very fragile. So for me, there's that question about, well, how do we create those spaces where we can come together and actually revalue the imagination, I suppose, create the optimal conditions for our hippocampus to flourish.
I can picture the activist campaign, Protect the Endangered Hippocampi.
Not the endangered hippopotamus.
Not
quite. The endangered
quite.
Hippocampus, yeah.
Now, look, if we assume that indigenous people continue to cultivate imagination, have you or will you consult with those cultures in your exploration?
I have been talking to, I've talked to some interesting movements in India who are doing very interesting work around alternative approaches to education. And I'm soon talking to a guy in Hawaii who's one of the indigenous people in Hawaii about the way that they use visioning and imagination to tell a story and to really bring the future of that island to life. And I recently interviewed a woman who does a lot of work with indigenous people in South America and looking at what they bring to that. So, yes, that is a part of the exploration.
Now, Britain's Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher adopted a slogan from Herbert Spencer that said, "There is no alternative to the market-based system of capitalism." Rob Hopkins, what is your response?
There's always an alternative. It was one of the many ludicrous things that Margaret Thatcher said over the years. And the idea that there's no alternative is a perfect way to shut down the imagination in any setting. If you say, no, that's it, there's no alternative. You know, of course there's an alternative. And part of the problem, I think, is that a lot of us swallowed that. And that actually what we see now as being this kind of terror of these sort of dystopian visions of the future, the degree to which we struggle to imagine a future which is fair, sustainable, a society that is able to live within its limits. Part of that is because we have been sold this idea that there is no alternative to neoliberal capitalism in the way that we currently see it. And I think part of our work, part of what we try and do in transition is to say, of course there is. In fact, actually, you know, if somebody says to me, well, if there is an alternative, what would it be like? Describe it to me. You know, I always sort of piece something together out of things that already exist. You know, I can say, well, I would wake up in the morning in a beautiful apartment block built out of straw bales with local straw, local timber, 100% composting toilets. I'd walk out through the gardens, through streets with not very many cars in and, you know, really thriving local businesses, and I'd drop my kids off at a school which had changed how it taught, and there was much less testing, and the school was a real example of all of these kind of things. And, you know, I can paint that picture for ages, but when I'm doing that, it's not some flight of fancy of my imagination. It's really piecing together things I've already seen. I've stayed in an apartment block like that in Geneva. There are schools like that in Finland. You know, all of this stuff already exists in different places. So actually, when somebody says there's no alternative, it really speaks to their chronic lack of the imagination. The danger when someone like Thatcher says it is that it kind of becomes infectious and people buy into it.
Your journey got me wondering, is there a public imagination, or is imagination always a private and individual experience?
I think there's both. I think that we do have a kind of a shared imagination and stories that we tell each other and stories that we believe and that we buy into collectively. Yeah, and I guess that was what that research I mentioned at the beginning was looking at, was there was a big enough data set that she was saying, well, actually, this looks like it's reflective of the collective imagination. Clearly, we all have our own individual imaginations, and there are things that we can do to make ourselves as imaginative as possible. But at the same time, I think, you know, that when the imagination really sparks into life for me, and it's something that I've seen again and again with transition projects in many different places, is when people come together. And the thing that I've been writing about recently is about this idea of what if, you know, making these what if spaces where people can come together with other people and say, what if we had our own money here, or we had our own bank, or what if we did this in a different way and then went off and did it? You know, we've been doing transition now for 11 or 12 years, and we now think of it as being a movement of communities who are reimagining and rebuilding the world, and you have to do both of those things together. I was in Liège in Belgium a couple of weeks ago, where they had I went there 4 years ago, where their transition group had just started, and I went to an event that was all framed around a what-if question. And the question was, what if, in a generation's time, the majority of food eaten in this city came from this city? or the land around this city, the land immediately around this city. And they invited together farmers and scientists and chefs and shop owners and everybody with an interest in food, and just opened a space with that as the what-if question. And then I went back after 4 years, and they've started 14 cooperatives. They've raised 5 million euros from local people. The municipality, the local government, are completely behind it and making a load of their land available to the whole thing. I met the mayor of the city who said, 8 years ago, we wanted to be a smart city. Now we want to be a transition city. You know, and when I talked to them and said, well, how did you get here? How did you... You know, in 4 years, how did you make all this stuff happen? And he said, well, because we had a really strong what if question, and we held that space. We didn't say we've got it all worked out. They just held a space that invited people's imagination in, and then when they did that, all kinds of things were then able to happen.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Rob Hopkins. He's the author of many books on creating communities resilient to problems of the present and the expected shocks as a troubled future unfolds, or perhaps as a better future unfolds. Is that a fair assessment, Rob?
I'm very interested in the future, and I refuse to kind of buy into that idea that the future is inevitably going to be rubbish. And I think there's every possibility that we could still create a future that's really quite amazing, but it needs us to come together and get on with it, really.
The first transition town was famously in Totnes, England. We broadcast in several countries, though, and more than half of Radio EcoShock listeners are in the United States. Can I ask how far the transition town movement has penetrated into America?
Yes. So it says there's 163. I just looked up. There's 163 transition initiatives in the U.S., and you can find them on transitionus.org. Transition U.S., which exists as what we call a national hub, so it's like the national organization which sort of supports and trains and tries to connect together the different transition groups across the U.S., so it's something like that, yeah, about 170. I know they had a national conference earlier this year, and there seems to be a lot of activity happening in lots of places.
I do get feedback from listeners who are involved in it or want to be, but I do worry that my own program and even the science presented by Radio EcoShock can become trapped in a bubble of English speakers in Western-style culture. So I'm curious how transition is received in other parts of the world. I mean, is the movement still valid, say, in heavily populated areas of China or Indonesia?
Yeah. So when we started transition, we were really inspired by something that was called contraction and convergence, which was a climate model at the time which said, at the moment, the global north consumes about 80% more than it should. It needs to bring its carbon footprint down by about 70-80% to a level where the global south can then meet them, and then that's the kind of point at which things can continue, you know? So our kind of founding inquiry really was, what does it look like if we see that move as a move forward? Because if in the global north we see that as a move away from something, as a move towards less, as kind of going backwards somehow, then it's not going to happen. If we don't have the stories about how remarkable, how extraordinary, how fascinating that world could be, with its amazing flavors and tastes and events and all the stuff that could happen there, then we're just simply not going to do it. So for us, it felt really important that we were basically designing a sort of a detox program for the affluent West, if you like. We weren't designing a model that was going to work in China or Africa or somewhere like that. What's been really fascinating has been to see transition being picked up by people in the global south and taking it and making it their own and changing it and adapting it. There's a lot of transition happening in Brazil, in Colombia, in favelas, in São Paulo, in Brazil, a lot happening in sort of Southeast Asia, Korea, South Korea, starting in China, bits of China, little parts of Africa. And in South America, it often kind of sits alongside the kind of Buen Vivir, Via Campesina kind of movements. And people pick it up as a tool and adapt it and make it their own. And that's really fascinating to see for me, because that really wasn't the original intent of the model, I suppose.
But that is really exciting. And you've written a new guide. It's called 7 Steps to Creating a Sustainability Transition Movement in Your Community. Where will that appear? How can my listeners find that?
Well, actually, those come from something that we did that's called the Essential Guide to Doing Transition, which is a free guide that you can find at transitionnetwork.org. It's there as a resource for people to download. It's a kind of a full-color guide to getting transition started where you are. And there's two there. There's that one, and then there's also another one that we did for COP21 when that took place in Paris, December 2015, that was called 21 Stories of Transition, where we went out to the transition movement and said, we're off to Paris. We're going to go and fly the transition flag at the COP21 negotiations. Which stories should we take? And we were sent in hundreds of stories by transition groups from around the world, and we condensed those down into 21 and produced this really good little book that tells all of those stories. So if people want a crash course in what transition is and then some tools for how to get started, have a look at transitionnetwork.org and you'll find them all there.
On the subject of climate change, I've just finished a series of interviews with top scientists, and they have dire news about much earlier than expected signs of severe climate change, things like the ocean currents slowing down and a long list. How seriously do you see the climate challenge, Rob?
It's the thing that keeps me awake at night, really. I mean, it's, I suppose, one of the main reasons why I've given the last 12 years of my life and before to all of this has really been because of the science those guys are talking about. I have children, and maybe grandchildren aren't too far away in my life, and that's really what motivates me, absolutely. I think the bit where I tend to focus my energy is on that, you know, if we were to stay below 1.5 degrees, what would that take? And what would it look like? And Kevin Anderson, who's one of the most brilliant sort of interpreters of climate science, I think, had a conference recently that was called the Radical Emissions Conference that was about what would that be like, actually? If we were able to stay below 1.5 degrees, what would that mean for transport, for food, for energy, for employment, you know? And as people, all of that stuff, you know, we could do that. We could still do that. You know, it's not that we will avoid climate change, because climate change has already started, but we could certainly avoid it spiraling completely out of control. But in order to do that, we have to be able to imagine what it would be like to wake up in that world, and how extraordinary it could be, and what possibilities it would offer, and then tell that story. And so that people are thinking, well, why would we want to go there when we could go there? That could just be fantastic. So it's that bit about imagination and story that really fascinates me. I've really noticed over the last few years how my role of going out and talking about transition has increasingly become kind of being a storyteller. You know, I gather stories from one place, I take them to another place, and it's really a movement of stories that we always say to people. You can start a transition initiative wherever you are. It doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to pay an annual membership. All the resources are there for you for free. The only condition is that you share your stories. And so whether it's people starting a food garden in a street in Brussels, or the guys in Sarasota doing food gleaning projects, or, you know, big local currency community energy projects, those are the stories that people need to hear, because they don't hear that stuff anywhere else. And if the imagination needs anything, it needs a kind of a big palette of ideas and possibilities and stories to draw from. That's really what feeds it and where it all comes from, you know.
Do you think we can retool this civilization, sort of remake it from the inside while it's still standing? Or do we need a collapse before something new can really happen?
Well, my sense about collapse is, you know, and I've been around a lot of people for a long time who've been motivated by collapse, is, you know, from what I was talking about before about the hippocampus and the idea that the imagination shrinks and contracts in a fearful, when it's fearful, when it's in anxiety, is that if we're going to have a collapse, then the thing that will make us most effective during that time will be the health of our imagination, our ability to imagine our way through that and be creative and flexible and adaptable. And if we're going to avoid a collapse, it'll be because we're at our most imaginative. And so for me, whichever way we look at it, being as imaginative as possible is really important. And actually, if we try to motivate people to get involved by warning of an imminent collapse, I think we don't engage very many people. It doesn't really work. It's not a very skillful way to really inspire people to get involved in something. And I've seen it with a lot of people I know who, you know, there are a handful of people who you can talk to about collapse and who are able to somehow transmute that into being very driven and motivated and getting on with stuff. But most people don't respond in that way. What works much better, in my experience, is painting a picture of what we could create from this point going forward.
It's interesting you say that, because I've talked to psychologists, including from Britain, who have said the same thing, that humans are not motivated by fear towards real change. There's another book out called The Transition Starts Here, Now, and Together. I haven't seen it. What can you tell us about that?
So this is a book which a guy called Lionel Astouk, a French writer, came to Totnes, where I live, and interviewed me every day for a week, and then went away and wrote this book. So it's kind of my words, but kind of arranged by him. And it's a particular kind of a format that is very popular in France, this sort of interview-based book. So it'll be really interesting to see if anybody reads it in the US, or, you know, how it goes. I think it has a really nice flow to it. It's kind of me talking about me, I suppose, a bit, and where the transition idea came from, and, you know, how it grew, how it evolved, what it looked like in Totnes. So it's quite sort of autobiographical, quite conversational. And in France, people have really, really enjoyed it. It came out of a film that was called Tomorrow, or in France was called Demain, which came out in late 2015, which was a film about, you know, the world we could create now, the tomorrow that we could create, which I appear in, and which was incredible phenomena in France. It won Best Documentary in the French Oscars. It was millions and millions of people saw it. It ran in mainstream cinemas for months and months. So this is a series of books that they've done with some of the key people in the film going into it in more depth and kind of telling their story.
I have been hoping to talk with you for a long time, and now here we are, and I still feel like I'm missing something important. Would you like to just take over this microphone as we wrap up and tell our listeners anything else that's on your mind these days?
I guess it feels to me like, you know, what we've done in transition for the last 12 years has been an experiment, really, and it's an experiment that many of your listeners will have been part of and contributed to and seen happening around where they live. And I love being part of something that has that permission to play and that permission to experiment. It feels very rewarding now to look and see some of the stuff that's happening in transition groups where they're starting to make a real difference and build new businesses, build new infrastructure. And that's the stuff that gets me out of bed, you know. It's like the story I mentioned about Liège or all the other places that you go to where people are saying, this is the thing that we want to do. This is our future. This is our story for the world that we want our grandchildren to see. And we've started it, and it's going really well. And I feel like I know more people than I ever knew before. And I feel part of something historic that's moving, something that's changing. You know, I'm with other people. We're working together. We trust each other. There's something so magical about that. I just love it. Every time I see it or experience it, I kind of see the future, the hope for the future that we're all trying to create.
We've been hearing from the social activist famous among millions of people wanting resilient ways of living. Rob Hopkins is the author of two key books, The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience, and The Transition Companion, Making Your Community More Resilient in Uncertain Times. He is now offering a 7-step guide toward community building, and soon we hope a book that will literally stimulate our imagination. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Rob Hopkins, thank you so much for being with us on Radio EcoShock, and I hope we can talk again.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. check into our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening this week and caring about our world.